So some of the concerns that I tell us are limited. And also the Yamasuko Declaration is in countries where it is not viable for operators to fly from South Africa to those countries. For instance, if you take Burkina Faso, the other proposal is that they should be happy in South Africa. Then you've got Ghana, you've got Lagos, you've got Seneca, which there's more frequencies in those countries. So it doesn't become attractive for anyone to operate in those countries. Those are the countries that we have more massive interactions. One of the generations that just started operating in South Africa end of 2010. And the visa comes in the visitors coming over to put up in their establishment, not in
knowing that there were other arrangements that we made. But having said that, we do not want to discuss it because they have to be in them and we don't think it should be anybody. Therefore, I do support also the fact that small businesses should be considered and incentives for small should be considered. The department is making a lot of effort to try and meet the enterprises providing all the up-and-coming ventures. They have got things like TAP, organizations or offices like TAP, where people get their assistance. And there are some grants that are offered and so on. And although this is not tourism, but even the NAF has pledged a lot of millions onto some high-class business, which is not tourism, but I'm just saying because money seems to be coming out in millions to assist people. You know of the Luminance story. There is a dire need to look at institutional capacity building, capacity building strategies or programs for municipal officials, tourism officials, because also people are handicapped by the fact that, by ignorance, they are handicapped by ignorance. They don't know the potential of tourism and therefore they do not prioritize it. Partnerships with SALGA must be established in training municipal local economic development strategies and the tourism and tourism staff. The idea of forming partnerships again cannot be overemphasized. Similarly, you know, municipalities need to create themselves conducive environments for tourism to flourish. Again, it comes back to prioritizing local structures or local municipalities do not prioritize tourism. But the sooner we encourage them to do so, the better, because they will provide. They will then be alert to the demands of tourism, like preparing roads, looking after their museums, looking after their libraries, and so on. That they will do only if they are away. Also, with the municipalities, with the NDT, National Department of Tourism, we need to assist municipalities in making a solid case for the importance of tourism. We cannot really overemphasize this. To make also, we need to make politicians at local level to understand the value of tourism in the local economy. Having said that, there are struggling municipalities which. There are struggling municipalities which need to be assisted in terms of. Thank you. The chairperson is conscientizing me about time. I'm sorry, I've taken too long. We need to. Okay, what can we do without water and our environment? The chairperson also talked about the pollution, the state of pollution in that Zambela. South Africa actually has a lot of those areas like that. We've got areas where they've even come up with strategies like Basa, Njengobobo, things like that. So those are all strategies to make sure that we lessen the carbon print in South Africa. Yesterday we had something that was very, very trying a bit of a scare of obliteration by, you know, inundation by pollution. It was quite frightening, but our DG mitigated our case very, very well. And so, but we also need to take care of the carbon footprint. As Parliament also, we need to look into differentiated but equal development in terms of restrictions posed by carbon footprint regime, as they know from the European Union. Having said that, I have cut out quite a number of items which I wanted to talk about, but in respect of my chairperson, I think I will just say, you know, just the outline for the day. We are going to come out of here and having received the presentation, we then raise recommendations for adoption as a resolution. And then after that, we we return to the main hall where we are going to report back. I don't know who's going to be doing that. The chairperson will give a direction. And then the summit resolutions will then be tabled and adopted. And I think the deputy minister will close the summit for us. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. It's normal, as a member of the Parliament, we used to this podium of speaking and speaking for a long time as a politician. I wanted to do the same, then I have to retreat from that. But now let me give you the opportunity to present us, to present their papers in this, in this, in this meeting. I'll start with Professor May Lole, just to give us presentation. I think it's in 30 minutes.
Marketing and production information. So the concept
complexity of the tourism product makes it essential that we have to match supply and demand, because it affects all in both the supply chain and the demand for tourism. So we as a division were given a brief by the National Department of Tourism to determine the particular experience needs, because tourism is not really the utilization of a product, it's an experience. Of the five key domestic market segments that will inform more appropriate and specific product development with specific reference to accommodation facilities, food and beverage services, attractions, activities, transport services, events, packages and tours, and special interest offerings as key product categories. So this was a tall order. And we had a number of challenges when we thought about how we were going to address this and how we were going to answer this problem or this brief from the NET. So some of these challenges that we had to consider is, how do we capture the complex and composite nature of a tourism offering and experience and avoid simply providing a database of products? Because what we don't want to do, and I think what is being done at the moment, there is an audit of tourism products being done, which is an ongoing process, but we needed to look at whether these products were appropriate to the needs of the market. So that put a bit of a different perspective on it. We had to decide where we do this research. Obviously it's within South Africa, but was it the whole of South Africa? Was it Gauteng, Tshwane, Pitsonewater, the Midlands, Meander, Kruger National Park? So we had quite a challenge to decide and to motivate why we were going to select certain regions. And then because of the complexity of the envisaged results and how comprehensive these results would be, we had to think of a way to present them in a simple, usable way. In other words, to have something on the table to the NDT that could be done anywhere by any of the tourism stakeholders. And we had to consider whether the study and what came out of the study could be replicated in different settings, different areas, different sectors, different routes, different towns, and then also how policymakers and tourism stakeholders would be able to use this model that we decided to develop. So we took an approach of looking at developing a model that met the following criteria. That it could be replicated in any geographical region, town, area, or even tourism sector or specific product offering. It should be able to be a simple and graphical presentation which could position the market segments, the needs of the market segments, in terms of a region's overall ability to meet their demands, in other words, taking into account all those sectors that the NDT referred to, accommodation, events, transport, etc. And also, at the same time, to position the market segment in terms of the region's ability to meet their demands per tourism sector. We had to sort of show the gaps at one glance, so are the needs being met by this particular region and everything that's being offered to the tourists in a particular region. And we also wanted to allow for comparison across different areas, see whether our model would allow for that. And then also to do it in a way that a tourism stakeholder, could take it and make it their own for their region or product. So the research objectives were to determine the product needs of the different domestic market segments. And we were given the market segment. So generally, in looking at your market for a product, that would also be a challenge, because you need to determine what the experience needs of your market is. Not only whether they want to sleep in a comfortable bed and what the product has in a tangible way to offer, but what experiences do they seek from a particular product or service. So we were fortunate in that sense that we were given a set of market segments that we had to work with. But this is something that for ongoing research, because tourist profiles change,
people need to look all the time at how the market is changing and the market demand is changing. We had to review the currently available tourism product offerings in terms of their appropriateness to meet the particular needs of each identified domestic market. So, again, we did not want to do an audit of product offerings. We didn't want to say there were so many hotels, so many beds, so many roads, accessibility museums, events, because that simply did not answer the question of whether these were, and we heard yesterday, they're not all tourism destinations, or not all destinations are tourism attractions. Yes, they could feasibly be negative attractions, but we had to distinguish between those kinds of destinations as well. And then obviously in the particular regions we sought, we had to look at the gaps and provide recommendations for specific product development. So the end result would be a model to position a region in terms of matching the supply and demand of that particular region. So how did we select the regions? We decided, well, we would select four tourism nodes, as we call them, because we could make some comparison across the nodes. At the end of the day, they were too many, but we went ahead with that because, as you will see, that it is very complex, and I think tourism stakeholders would be interested in their specific region, their specific product, not necessarily four, but for our purposes, we selected the four, and we restricted information and data collection to these nodes. The four we selected, we identified as potential growth points that the MET had suggested and other tourism authorities, or we looked at areas that currently had, we perceived to have a greater need in terms of information available on that particular region. So they were not that well known, or there was a wonderful resource, and the Honourable Member mentioned Eastern Cape. There's a lot going on there. There's beautiful coastlines, but is it that well known? So we looked at that as well. So the four regions we selected was the West Coast, Central Karoo, O.R. Tambo District, and Eshlanveni District in Bushbuck Ridge. So those are the four. Obviously, there's many others, but we made that selection. And just to give you an idea, because I'm going to use the West Coast later on as an example, of the number of little towns that are on the West Coast, and many of you living here will know that. So we had to look at a broad view of whether the West Coast would meet the needs of the five selected or the five market segments. So what we did is we just listed the six sector-specific product offerings. We said, okay, there's transport, there's package tours, there's local tours, accommodation, attractions, and events. We were going to look at the offerings in terms of food and beverage, but that was too complex, so we limited the research, or we left that out of the research. And we gave them each little icon, which does become relevant later on. The five market segments that SA Tourism had identified in 2010 gave us information on their demographics, their age, their profile, their income, marital status, kids, etc. And they also did give us some idea of what their experiential needs were. So, for example, your spontaneous budget explorers, as they termed them, would seek adventure. That generally be young people of all races seeking adventure. The part of the trip is the journey to the destination. That's part of the holiday. It's not only the destination. They like a lot of activities. They like socializing. They like nightlife. They like fun. I wish I was 22 again. So that was the kind of thing that they were looking at and looking for in going to a specific destination in general. So that was one segment. And so they specified or identified five different ones. They talked about they identified the New Horizon families, which have their specific needs. They also identified what they termed high life enthusiasts. These are high income people that want a whole different set of activities at a particular destination. They talked about seasoned leisure seekers and well-to-do Mzansi families. And each of them had, obviously there's some overlap, but we could make some distinction in terms of the needs of the various market segments. So we just shortened we gave an acronym to each of the five domestic tourism market segments, as you will see there. The research methodology we used, I'm not going to go through this, this is just to ensure that you know that it was done with scientific integrity. One can use different methodologies. We decided to use a quantitative and a qualitative methodology. Quantitative in terms of the structure of the questionnaire, where we could do some frequency analyses, and we could look at how many people said what, but also we needed to determine what the knowledgeable people in an area, the tourism stakeholders, felt were important in terms of the supply and the demand within their region. So the qualitative aspect, we did in-depth interviews with all the tourism professionals in various capacities in each node. We used a self-administered questionnaire, which we followed up with telephone and personal interviews in each tourism node. And we did quantitative and qualitative data analysis. So this is where it gets a little complex, and I'm going to try and put it simply, and I hope that you'll be able to understand, because I have a tendency to overcomplicate things, which my husband tells me I do. So what we did, we rated each market segment, so those five market segments, in terms of each tourism region or node, which were the four regions. And we looked at the demand of each market segment based on the needs of that market segment, and rated it against the current supply of offerings in each sector. So you'll see that we looked at, for example, the spontaneous budget explorers, and we looked at them in terms of what do they want generally, how do they travel to a destination. Do they want to go on package tours or inclusive kind of tours? We looked at what local tours and packages in the region were available. We looked at the type of accommodation they want. We looked at the attractions that they go to or that they wanted to go to. And we looked at what events would attract that particular market segment. And we did the same thing for each market segment, so it was the five market segments and against the six sectors for each node. So it's times. So the document was very thick that we eventually did produce. But that gives you an indication of what we basically did. And we decided that we'll build what we call the match model. In other words, we would look at how the supply of each of these sectors met the demand, overall and per sector. Okay, so based on the analysis, we gave a tick if the supply met the demand, if the supply was okay, or across, the supply and the demand, or across where it was not. So we had the rating codes as where the current supply meets the demand of these five, or the potential demand of these five sectors, these five market segments. We could say that there was a tick for supply and a tick for demand. Where we saw there was a supply, but or there was not enough supply, but there was a demand, we said, okay, supply has some shortcomings. There's not enough product offerings. Or something is wrong in one of the sectors of the product offerings. But there is a demand for it, or a potential demand. Again, we said there could be limited supply or inadequate supply, but there's also limited demand. Some of these segments would not want to go to some of the attractions or the regions. It just wasn't what they wanted to do. And we said that finally we could have supply, but then there's no demand for the supply that's available there, or the demand is untapped. So that could be another reason. So just to give you one example of how we did it, because it can get rather overwhelming information. We took the New Horizon families. We looked at where you can see the arrow. We looked at their needs in terms of events. And we looked at the West Coast. And we said that according to our results, this market enjoys accessible natural places with child-friendly facilities. They want to relax and spend quality time with family and friends. Education and entertainment is of paramount importance as they want to broaden their children's horizons in terms of cultural and heritage activities. So that was just very briefly a summary of what they wanted in terms of the events in a specific region. And then we said as far as the supply, so events and activities in terms of edutainment are demanded by this market, but not supply, as most events are focused on an adult market. So in the West Coast, most events are focused on an adult market, such as wine route activities, crayfish and cultural festival, West Coast marathon, and Berbera. So it's mainly for adults. There weren't that many child-friendly type where you could, as this specific market wanted. And this was an overall view. So there was lack within that area. And then we just made some practical suggestions as we went along to say that what we would suggest is the development of an educational rock-off group is recommended, etc., etc. And we did that for all five markets, for all four regions in terms of all six sectors. So that is what the total brief one looks like. But then we wanted to plot this so that it would become even easier to see. So we plotted based on the rating given of each sector, and we divided our plotting area into four quadrants, and we said there's on the vertical axis you've got current offerings, and the horizontal axis current needs. And we used the 6-point scale, which I'll just explain to you. So if we look at the New Horizon families again, and where we plotted there, you can see on the vertical axis we've got product offerings. On the horizontal axis we've got market needs. And we said that we added up all the supply ticks. So the supply is 1, 2, 3, 4 ticks. So we went up, and I haven't got a pointer here because I'm sorry. So if you go on the vertical axis, you count basically 4 units. It positions NHF, New Horizon families, at level 4. If you plot them against the demand, there's a demand throughout. People want to go, this market wants to go to the West Coast and experience it. So the demand is high, and it was at six ticks. So that was the simple method we used to position. So you could see that for the New Horizon families, there's a high demand, but there's some problems in supply. We need to look at what those promised tourism stakeholders in that area need to look at what is missing there, because there is a demand. And we did the same for the spontaneous budget explorers, for the seasoned leisure seekers, for the, I've forgotten all the names, Zanzi families, and the highlight enthusiasts. You can see the highlight enthusiasts don't have that much of a demand, and there is also not that much of a supply there. So there you can see very quickly how we plotted the various sectors. Okay, so we just gave an overall result in terms of the various positions, and we did the similar thing for Central Karoo, Bushbuck Ridge, West Coast, and Owatamba. And if you look at that, you can see how one can, at one glance, see what how they compare with one another, the regions. And that makes sense to us in the overall sense of things. Then you drill down to look deeper into the results of what sector is a problem, because this gives you the overall sector. So that is the model that we use, and we provided some overall recommendations, saying that you have to position the market segments, and this is in terms of all the results, not only the West Coast. You have to position the markets as a relationship between current offerings and demand, which provides a foundation for decision makers to formulate appropriate responses to the gaps highlighted in the product offerings. Decision makers need to decide whether the appropriate responses to gaps in a particular market market segments should be addressed through the improvement of the tourism offering or through a greater focus on developing the demand, or both. And then specific strategies need to be put in place to overcome gaps, identified with due consideration of the reason for these gaps. So the product offering needs to be improved, or the awareness of the product offering needs to be created. So there may be a product, but the domestic tourist is not aware of it, which seems to be, in many of the cases we found, the actual problem. So really, just in conclusion, this model that we developed provides a tool for replication in three ways. It matches the product offerings of all the sectors with the demand of the five market segments, whatever market segments one identifies for your own product. And it can be done in any of tourism node or tourism area or tourism sector. It can match the product offerings of one specific sector, transport, accommodation, to the demand of all the segments that you have, or you can have any permutation of this. You can use a sector, one market segment, and one region or one product. And just to conclude, we have just last week concluded the same positioning of the Bergrivier municipality, which is portable to take back from Veldrift, who asked us to come and apply it there. And we're also working on the accommodation sector in Lukhofong in Limpopo for the five identified segments. So you can see there's a wide range, and one could literally do it for one sector, for one product, for a museum, for a transport, for a game lodge, in this way. I thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Can we get another presentation from the Professor Daniel Jereff from Western University? And also give you 20 minutes, Professor.
My colleague Mark is going to give the presentation.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dan. I see that we're both from the Department of Geography and Environmental Studies at the University of the Western Cape. And I'm going to do the presentation, but Dan, you're welcome to intercede at any time. We haven't been involved in any projects as such, but we were asked to talk a bit about the prospects for niche tourism development in South Africa. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give a little bit of background on niche tourism and on the development prospects for niche tourism, some of the reasons why we need to look at niche tourism. And after that, I'm going to focus on one particular niche which I think has a lot of development potential, which is underdeveloped in this country, which I feel has got a lot of development potential, and which also links up with the World Tourism Organization's Tourism Month theme of tourism and water. You heard about that one yesterday. It also, can link up with the objectives of the NDT. It also brings in some of the things we've been talking about, like rural tourism, arts and crafts, job creation, and utilization of unique natural resources. Right, do you recognize that mountain? Anyone know which mountain? Well, that mountain is a famous mountain in mountaineering circles, one of the most famous in South Africa. Torberkop, it's called. It's on the road between Western Otsur and the Ladysmith. Right, just a bit of introduction. Niche tourism. Niche tourism has actually got its origins in marketing, in niche marketing. A niche market, based on DTI here, and DTI has been doing a lot of work on niche tourism. But a bit later, a niche market is defined as a niche market, a group in which individuals in the group are identifiable by the same specialized needs or interests and have a strong desire for the products on offer. Similarly, niche tourism markets are then made up of identifiable groups of individuals with similar interests, needs, and wants, identified by market segmentation, similarly to what our last speaker was talking about, segmenting the market. And then specific products could then be tailored to meet the needs of particular market segments. The size of a niche tourism market, that's debatable. You know, cultural tourism is in fact a niche, a macro niche, a larger niche, but then that could be subdivided into things like art tourism, film tourism, township tourism, and so on, micro niches. So, there are a few management implications of niche tourism. The concept then has emerged in recent years to counter what commonly referred to as mass tourism. You're looking at it very simplistically, you've got mass tourism on the one side and niche tourism on the other side. Some of the problems that have been associated with mass tourism on the economic side, high leakage, in other words, a lot of the money coming in, foreign currency coming in, and even currency from other parts of the country coming in, then leaves because people are paying for goods that are bought in from the outside or expatriate managers or money which leaves that area. Very low trickle-down rates. Now that the benefits really don't spread to the surrounding areas. And then that in the end leads to spatial inequalities with a few areas of development and many other areas in between with low rates of development. Environmental problems like damage to vegetation, pollution, overcrowding, and then socio-cultural problems. With the commodification of culture, with the turning of culture into a commodity for sale, it often leads to loss of authenticity and in the end damage to traditional culture. So for managers and planners, niche tourism does appear to offer great opportunities. Tourism is more sustainable, less damaging, and more capable of delivering and higher spending tourists. And for tourists, niche tourism offers a more meaningful set of experiences in knowledge that their needs and wants are being met. Just especially mass tourism, which is essentially conventional tourism, large numbers of tourists, usually stage settings like resorts, beach areas, and so on. Niche tourism more catering to special interests, things like cultural, activity-based tourism involving smaller numbers of tourists and usually more authentic settings like within communities. Your macro niches like cultural tourism, again, heritage, ethnic, religious, education, and many, many more. Environmental, nature tourism, wildlife tourism, adventure tourism, geotourism. I'm going to talk a bit more about the health tourism side of things, but health is within that medical tourism, thermal spring tourism, spa tourism. And then there are countless, probably hundreds of other niches, such as graphic volunteers, sport, youth. The list just goes on and on and on. Now, the DTI and SOGA a couple of years ago, they really put it all together very nicely. In fact, a couple of years ago, they did a big project on ecotourism and researched that niche and published a very good publication on it. But they really summarized the benefits of niche tourism for local economic development. And it helps diversify the tourism economy by creating new markets. It has greater growth potential than mainstream tourism. And usually it's a high yield per visitor in terms of foreign exchange earnings and consumer spending. Even though the niche markets are smaller inside the main tourism markets, the spending is generally higher. It stimulates creation of quality jobs and requires specialized skills as opposed to the sort of low-skilled jobs that one sees normally with mass tourism, you know, in hotels and so on. And activities as part of niche tourism are often community-based and located outside of traditional tourist areas, and does encourage geographic distribution of the benefits of tourism. And then more local spending generally takes place. Niche tourism offerings attract independent travelers, people who spend their money within the local communities at the sites, as opposed to, you know, prepaid package tours. Okay, the Western Cape has actually moved in quite a major way towards niche tourism. I'm not going to go into detail, but in their last tourism development plan, they identified 26 markets on which to focus. So you can see the adventure, agri, backpacking, youth, beach, bird watching, gambling, gay, religious, scenic, whale watching, wine, yachting. All of these were identified as niches with the potential for development. So the question then is, you know, with all these hundreds of niches, which tourism product should really be developed? It's a difficult one, but essentially one needs to look at unique location-specific products, something that identifies us, sets us apart from our competition, something that makes us different. And then together with that, something that has growth potential that we can really build into a product. Now, the niche that I'm going to look at in more detail is the Wellspring Health Tourism in South Africa. You can see the World Tourism and Theme Tourism and Water, particularly our common future. So I've decided just to look at a water theme, which I feel is underdeveloped and can be developed as a niche in this country. You know where that one is? Recognize that. Tugela River, Shishu in KwaZulu Natal. Right, South Africa's thermal springs. So that's about 80 thermal springs. Temperatures range from about 39 degrees centigrade up to 64 degrees centigrade. Only about 50 of these are developed into resorts. Most were established over the last few hundred years as sort of semi-medicinal spa resorts because of the apparent healing properties of the mineral water. And in most of these springs, there's some amazing stories of amazing cures over the years. In recent decades, the importance of health as a motivator to visit these springs has declined. In fact, they pretty much all become family leisure resorts, with the medicinal side having fallen by the wayside completely. But what's happening now internationally, this tradition of taking the waters, of visiting thermal springs as part of health and wellness tourism is reviving in many parts of the world as part of alternative medicine. South African thermal springs are not a significant part of this growing international and domestic health tourism market. And essentially the danger that all our old healing traditions which are based on hot mineral water will be lost unless we can develop them and incorporate them into modern health and medical and wellness niche tourism products. Okay, just a quick map that you can see where these are the thermal spring resorts that are spread out throughout the whole country. That's a picture of the Caledon Spa. There's this huge resort that was built in 1904, and it was burnt down in about 1945, and it's never really been rebuilt. There's Caledon now is the only hot spring resort in the Western Cape which has got relatively sophisticated wellness tourism facilities, but nothing on the medical side. And people used to come all over the world for medical treatment at Caledon in the first part of the last century. Today, all that's left is what they call the Victorian spa bar. One pool, 49 degrees centigrade water with very, very high in iron and manganese. If you travel out from Cape Town into Worcester Valley, you get Gardini Spa. You get a very range of thermal spring resorts. Some of big resorts like this, Gardini Spa, which again has got no health or wellness facilities, even though they've got hot mineral water with a tradition of healing. It's essentially a family leisure resort. That is a picture taken in the 1930s of the hottest and strongest spring in South Africa, a place called Brandfleth, 126 litres of water per second at 68 degrees centigrade. And it's on a property belonging to correctional services. They use a bit of it for showers in the prison services, but for the most part, in fact, it's an interesting one because you know, that one of the ingredients of the springs is lithium. And you know, sort of used as an antidepressant to calm and relax you. And everyone here obviously feels it from spending time in the spring. So I think it might do some good to the prisoners from February. But the hottest and strongest spring in the country, and most of it is just running into the river. That's all there is. That's what you can see today. You can have a picnic and you can look at it, but there are no facilities for medical wellness, even not even for swimming. As you travel out towards Erzurum, just before 12 o'clock, you get to Barubata Spa, one of the smaller resorts, simple resort. Carlos Spa has a simple resort. The bars and the citrus down. And if you travel up north to the Khrabis, here we come to one of the thermal springs, which is just in a community area at Rimpasmark. They've got the spring and huge potential for developing this from a medicinal and a leisure point of view. It's actually a big attraction, and of course from there it can be spread to other attractions in the area. That's Shushu on the Tugela River in KwaZulu-Natal, completely undeveloped. And we've got hot springs in game reserves, Angami, which is near Freyheit, in KwaZulu-Natal as well. And big resorts like Natal Spa and at Bella Bella Warm Baths. So you see, we've got a range of resources. In fact, the facilities are all there, the infrastructure is there. It's just the product that needs to be developed. We need to expand it from health and wellness, from pure leisure, to bring back health and wellness. And we have an enormous product which can bring in all different sectors of tourism together. It can bring different parts of the country together. That incident is up in Venda at Sagodi or one of the spots up in Venda. Pepu Hot Spring Resort in Venda. So what do we actually need to do to develop the thermal spring health tourism niche? Firstly, research the healing properties of the different waters and find ways to incorporate the healing properties into modern health and medical and wellness niche tourism products. At the same time, we need to continue to offer products that attract domestic markets, because that is really the bread and butter of these springs, family leisure markets, domestic health and wellness markets, and then of course the retired market, which is enormous potential, because mostly these resorts are full during the weekends and empty during the week. In order to attract international health tourists, we need to offer health, medical and wellness facilities in combination with local tourist attractions and niche tourism products. So not just offer the thermal spring tourism on its own, but combine it with wildlife tourism, ecotourism, adventure tourism, cultural tourism, and set up spa routes. The springs are actually spread out enough so that one could stay in a different spring every night. And so the spas could be used as bases for visiting nearby attractions. And also structure midweek packages that then won't, and include accommodation at these resorts, but won't clash with domestic tourism, which is usually over weekends. And then the last fact that probably the most important recommendation is to encourage increased interaction between visitors to thermal spring resorts and the local communities surrounding the resort. Many of these springs are situated within community areas, such as Shushu, and there's one called Lalali, KwaZulu-Natal, Rimfatma, and use location-based herbal remedies in healing treatments, traditional treatments. Bring those into treatments which could be offered at these sprints. Involve the local people in the production and sale of health products. For instance, the bar of the Chipstar, it's an area known for its rooibos and for the buchu. And yet the resort is offering nothing in the way of treatments. Well, there are plenty of spas which do treatments with rooibos and buchu, and yet the resort itself is offering nothing. The whole of the Western Cape, we've got the Fynbos, where there's something like 120 different herbal remedies extracted from Fynbos. Every hot spring in the Western Cape could be offering Fynbos treatments, which is unique in the world and can attract people from everywhere, not only international but domestic tourists. So at the same time, promote local foods, particularly organically grown health foods and production and sale of arts and crafts, which could be then produced and sold at the resorts. And create opportunities for local communities to become involved in and benefit from tourism. So that's just one niche which I think can be developed and can, you know, provide answers to a lot of these questions that we've been asking. Just a few concluding remarks. The issue is it really the right way forward? I think there's still a market, definitely a market for mass tourism. I don't think we can just turn away completely from mass tourism. I think there definitely is a market for it, but at the same time we need to develop niche tourism. It is more sustainable economically, or can be, if it's properly planned, economically, environmentally, and socially, culturally. Very important, it does favor the development of unique location-specific products, which can then give us a competitive edge and growth potential. And it lends itself to small-scale operations, local community involvement, and the spreading of economic and other benefits of tourism. So, thank you. Thank you very much.
presentation is based on the research that my department has agreed or conducted in partnership with the National Department of Tourism. However, due to the fact that we have only 20 minutes, so I decided to summarize the findings of the study, so I will not be going into the methodology. And that is the outline of the presentation. I would like to start off by mentioning that the purpose of this presentation is mainly to look at the ways in which tourism can be a stimulus in facilitating community involvement. And perhaps I should indicate that the research that we did was based on a rural tourism route in KZN, and we're looking at the impact on rural communities, because as you are maybe aware, there are rural communities where people only read about tourism or they hear about tourism on the radio and they've never really been involved. So our research was mainly to look at how tourism routes can actually touch on those areas that have not been touched by tourism. I would like to look at what Mia said in relation to why tourism routes are initiated. Now, he mentioned those reasons, which diffuse visitors and disperse income from tourism to bring lesser known attractions and features into the tourism business, to increase the overall appeal of a destination, to increase the length of stay and spending by tourists, attract new tourists and to attract repeat visitors, to increase the sustainability of the tourism product and create opportunities for community involvement. Honorable Minister yesterday mentioned the significance of involving local communities in tourism development, and this is something that we also needed to find out in as far as the rural tourism is concerned. Now, one of the main constraints that is hampering tourism development and growth, particularly in rural areas, is the limited involvement of local communities, particularly the previously disadvantaged communities and individuals, most of whom live in rural areas. Now, rural areas, as you all know, have plenty of natural and cultural resources that can be used for tourism development. Tourism route development then has been seen as one of the strategies with the potential of making use of those resources that are readily available while facilitating the involvement of communities in tourism development. I believe we are all aware, it has been mentioned a number of times that tourism is everybody's business. In this case, each and every person in this country should be involved in one way or another, or should benefit in one way or another from tourism. Now, the justification for tourism routes. The development of tourism routes has gained a prominence worldwide in recent years. Now, this is just an indication that it is not only in this country where you're trying to reach rural area. This is happening everywhere in the world. Now, some of the reasons why rural tourism has been seen as a strategy is that, well, it's one of the tourism development strategies that are aimed at attracting and dispersing. I think that is very important, dispersing tourists to different parts of the country in both rural and urban areas. However, my focus here is on rural areas. The primary tourism project development strategies, countries, which is viewed as one of the best ways to secure sustainability in the tourism sector by clustering of activities and attractions in less developed areas and stimulating cooperation and partnership between communities in local and neighboring regions. It's a market-driven approach for tourism destination development. Now, if the tourism routes are well planned, then they have a potential of attracting a variety of users, such as international overnight visitors, longer-staying visitors and domestic users. Also, the potential of providing a good opportunity for developing less explored. The color is very weird. I hope you're able to read that. Okay. So tourism groups also have a think they're not providing a very good opportunity for developing less explored areas with valuable natural and cultural resources that appeal to special interest tourists such as every tourism. And they also have a potential of pulling and tying together several attractions that would independently not have the potential to entice visitors to spend time and money into a unique product. Now, based on a specific theme, tourism routes pull together a variety of activities and attractions with the purpose of stimulating entrepreneurial opportunities through the development of ancillary products and services. Now, I think it is important that at least we have the same understanding of what route tourism is all about, which is why I thought perhaps I would just give a definition. Route tourism refers to the initiative to link together a variety of tourism resources, activities, and attractions of smaller centers under a unified theme, thus stimulating entrepreneurial opportunities through the development of anchor and ancillary products and services, and collectively marketing these as a single tourism destination. Now, this concept is considered by many tourism analysts as an effective method of tourism distribution, especially of tourists traveling by road, by road, whether they are driving or they are cycling or they are hiking, as long as they are distributed, and they should be able to stimulate economic development of those areas. It is again important that when you talk about group tourism, that you understand what you mean by a community. Now, when you talk about communities, as far as group tourism is concerned, we are referring to all members of the public that reside adjacent to that tourism group, and those that are clustered around the node. We have mentioned, I've mentioned that on the tourism route, there will be some nodes. And now all the people that are found that reside around the nodes should be involved in tourism development. Now these are communities which, if the route is successfully and sustainably developed, should be involved in tourism development, and they should also benefit from this. Now through road tourism, a series of attractions found between these communities are linked together in order to promote local tourism development by encouraging tourists to move from one place to another, thus creating opportunities for a formation of local partnerships. This essentially means this and every place has got something that is unique, something that can actually be attractive, something that can be consumed. So it is a matter of people looking around their area to find out what is it that can be used as a tourist attraction. And several studies have indicated that among the main ingredients for successful and sustainable tourism development is community participation. Now, community members should be involved in all stages of route development, that is, from planning to implementation. In most cases, local community members are not really consulted, and they find themselves in a situation where something is already in existence and they don't know how to tap into that. Now, ideally, tourism routes should be designed to involve and benefit local communities, drawing from their skills, their expertise, their capabilities and aspirations. Now, it was mentioned earlier that when 2010 was coming, people had a lot of aspirations, they had a lot of expectations, and these were not met. Now, if community members are involved from the planning stages, then they are able to tap into what is happening. Now, route tourism development is very important because it empowers and benefits disadvantaged rural communities, stimulate local development and bring local communities together, and disperse visitors' money among a larger number of recipients, some of whom have been regarded as disadvantaged communities, and also promote business operations of poor people or poor communities. Now, unfortunately, some of the tourism routes in South Africa have been criticized for not involving local communities beyond the membership cases, local communities were not involved in root development, but get some benefits through job creation. Because even though they're not involved, but they do get jobs, and that is the beneficiation part, which is not necessarily the involvement part, because it is important that much of their benefits, that they are also involved in the whole endeavor. Now, Rosenstein and Sasser argued that the rhetoric about participation and involvement often must fundamental questions about whether individuals and communities have the assets to enable a take-up of what provides economic opportunities created by tourism routes. At a later stage, I will talk about the challenges. Now, the result of the study that we did on socioeconomic impacts of three rural tourism routes in KZN, the route that we did our research on was the King Shaka route, and Zululand Heritage route, and the Zululand Birding route. And that was conducted last year in 2012. It indicated that the majority of people who reside adjacent to these tourism routes were not involved in the establishment of these routes. And so some of them were not even aware of the routes. They didn't know that they were actually on the tourism route. Findings also indicated that there was minimal integration of local communities into the mainstream route development. Maxfield in 2000 criticized the Midland Meander, as I will indicate later, as one of the very advanced rules in KZN, for not providing benefits to disadvantaged communities and assisting black entrepreneurs. Now, since that time, the management of that route has actively pursued opportunities to assist emerging artists and tourism product owners in local areas. So there is beneficiation that is taking place there. Now, another example, the Highland Meander, which is in Mpumalanga, also exhibits weak state of black communities involvement. So you can see that even though there is some beneficiation, there is a lack of involvement of disadvantaged communities. Now, in South Africa, there is a considerable activity surrounding development of routes. Some of these routes are very successful in advance. An example is the Midlands, Meander in KwaZulu-Natal, the Wild Route in Western Cape, the Highland Meander in Mpumalanga, etc., etc. And through the central government's poverty fund, support has been provided for planning and launching of a series of tourism routes or trails that are designed to benefit poor communities by drawing them into the tourism mainstream. Now, the private sector and non-profit organizations, such as Open Africa, unfortunately we have a gentleman here from Open Africa, they're involved in route development, and subsequently tourism routes continue to be launched in every province in South Africa almost every year. The focus has mainly been on the number of these, the type, the economic impact of this, and not necessarily on the extent of community involvement. Now, an example, Open Africa, which is a non-profit organization, has been running since 1995, that uses tourism as an economic platform to create and sustain jobs in rural Africa, and has developed 62 routes in 6 countries. There could be more, but the last time I read and did my research, this was the number. In Southern Africa, we support approximately 2,161 businesses. Now, this is a case study which actually shows some of the tourism routes in KZN. And unfortunately, I don't have a pointer, but I guess you can read. The research was done on King Shaka tourism routes and Zululand heritage routes, as well as the bedding routes. Now, this is the number of routes that are found in KZN. And Midland Meander is one of the successful and advanced team-based routes in KZN, which has evolved over 20 years. And consistency in their marketing effort has been key to its success. The Midland Meander is a tourism route with its core product offering and a scenic rural environment. And of course they can see that there is a product mix and product diversification, which is actually important when routes and tourism routes are planned and implemented. Mission Niende is completely private sector funded, but there has been some cooperation with the public sector in the form of involvement of the Midlands and Niende Association in local planning issues. Now, another well-established route is the Zululand Heritage Route, on which we did our research, popularly known as Route 66, which stretches for 250 kilometers from Ntuthuko and the Toll Plaza to Pongola. Now, the development of Route 66 was informed by the findings of the research that was conducted by Tourism KwaZulu-Natal, which indicated that departing foreign and domestic tourists expressed their disappointment at the lack of opportunities to learn more about traditional culture and heritage of the local communities as well as wildlife. This then resulted in the development of a route that links available cultural heritage products and game reserves. Now every member of the community has then had an opportunity of actually participating in the development of this route, but unfortunately our research indicated that the majority of local communities were not really involved and they did not participate in the development of the route, and hence they were not really aware of its existence. Now, among special interests, there is roots in the Zululand birding route, which is regarded as one of the great live South Africa's first ever tourism products that showcases 605 bird species that are found in Zululand. Now, it is important for us to understand the characteristics that will make a route to be regarded as a successful. Now, when a route is well planned, it should have the theme, it should have numerous nodes, it should allow for an amalgamation of any kind of subsidiary nodes, and tourism routes can also vary in length. For instance, the Niende is 75 kilometers, and I indicated that the R66 is 260 kilometers. It should allow for product mix, and that the route can be developed both in urban and rural areas, and can link rural and urban areas, and they should offer opportunities for partnerships locally, nationally, and internationally. They can be private or public sector driven, or partnership between private and public. Now, ideally, rural tourism development should be dependent on the establishment of cooperation and close partnerships among key stakeholders. And forming the basis for successful rural tourism development is a strong political will at both local and regional levels to provide a foundation and a conducive environment for rural to thrive. Now, there are practical approaches that people can follow in order to develop successful routes. I will not go through all the of this. However, it is important that when communities think of developing routes, you know, they look at what is it that they really need to do in order for a route to be successful, not only to be successful, but also to be sustainable. Now, what are the challenges then of route tourism? Now, contrary to the common belief that there is a lack of enthusiasm and willingness, in most cases that is what people will say, that members of local communities lack enthusiasm and they're not willing to participate. Now, the research has actually discovered that that is not necessarily true. People are really enthusiastic, they really want to be involved, they want to participate, but they lack the capacity, which is something that was mentioned a number of times yesterday. They lack the capacity to initiate and sustain the route. They lack the necessary infrastructure. They lack the experience in creating associations and partnerships. Now, with the successful routes, I indicated that they've got very strong associations. Now, if local community members are unable to form those associations, they cannot establish a route, and neither can they sustain it. Now, there is a lack of awareness of institutional frameworks that support route development. They may hear people talking about route tourism, but they may not really understand the framework that is there to support that. And of course there is a problem with the finances, financial constraints. At times local community members are not aware where they can get financial support. And then there is a lack of pool of entrepreneurial and technical skills. Now, these are challenges that make it hard for local community members to participate in route tourism. Now, in conclusion, I would like to conclude by quoting Brennan American. That was way back in 2004, and now it's 2013. Now, they pointed out that while South Africa undoubtedly has a long way to go in achieving the integration of rural communities to its mainstream, there are few of us who would not admit that this is no longer a matter of choice. It is an imperative. That was 2004, and now it was 2013, and local communities are still not integrated in the mainstream of tourism development. So that is a challenge, and it obviously means there's something that needs to be done. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let us take this opportunity for Kashmir to go for tea break and stress of the legislation to another presentation. Thank you.
Yes.